It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Herschel Walker. Herschel Walker, football fame, Georgia, Texas resident. Going to run for, I guess, Senate in Georgia. Admitted on the Howard Stern Show, and this stopped me. This stopped me in my tracks today. I've heard a lot of crazy. I've heard a lot of insanity from Republicans over the last, forever. This one kind of blew my mind. Fortunately, in Herschel's case, not so much. Evidently, Herschel Walker told Howard Stern that he has played Russian roulette at least six times because he just loves competition so much. I just love to compete, he says. I just love to compete. You go, explain. Was the squirt gun full of ivermectin? What the? This could be someone in the U.S. Senate. This is indicative of the world we now live in. I love competition. I'm literally going to compete to blow my brains out. And when you look at this, you go, everything else, not as stupid. Everything else, not as ridiculous. When you go to this extent, we've now, I think, and I'm sure there's somebody out there going, no, Rick, if you think this is extreme, here, hold my beer. I will show you. I'm looking at this is the outer limit, no? The fact that you're really willing to blow your brains out just because I love to compete. Oh, good news today, though. Good news today. Joe Biden has officially won Arizona more times than any president in the history of the country. Again, you know, just from this one election, what is this now? Like the 65th time we've declared Joe Biden won Arizona. What I really love about today's story, though, because if you didn't know, Cyber Ninjas, they finally came out and finally put out their report. I remember they had some COVID scary stuff that they, well, don't want to put it out just yet. This was weeks ago when it was actually due. This is kind of, hey, Friday dump. So maybe nobody pays attention to Trump lost again. He's officially lost. Biden's officially won Arizona more. Trump's officially lost more. And I got to think that's probably not sitting well with the guy who, well, now synonymous with sore loser. What I love about this story, and before I get into it, what I love about it is that the Arizona GOP is really feeling cheated tonight. As their sham audit didn't produce the results of their wet dreams. But here's the thing. I still think that they got what they really wanted. With the people at the top, again, who know what this is really about, I think they got what they wanted. They wanted all of the data. They wanted all of the software information. They wanted the machines. They wanted to know how to actually steal an election in the future. And I think they got that. But the fact that the vote count didn't actually go their way. Ultimately, they spent about $7-8 million and got nothing but taken. The report, like I said, released today, 110 pages. Titled Maricopa County Forensic Audit by Cyber Ninjas. It almost sounds like a comic book, doesn't it? And it should be because it reads like one. It's in three sections. The first section is basically telling the state of Arizona all the things that's wrong with their election system and what they need to change. A lot of kind of a what's what of right-wing lunacy. You don't get to the part that says that Donald Trump lost again until the third section, well into it. So you got to get well into it to get to where the actual point is. He lost again. And this is the great part. This the best part. He lost by more votes than he did the first time. So I'm like, hey, you know what? Spend another $7-8 million. Count them again. Maybe you can jack that up another, couple of thousand more. Maybe you can do that again. It's just crazy. Now, what they've done is it wasn't really about this count. It was the issues. We were really concerned about the issues. You know, voter integrity, the process, that's what was so important. Not the fact that we were trying to steal the election. We were trying to be part of the 6-point plan and the 2-page memo, you know, sending, you know, an alternative set of electors so that they could break the Elections Act. The Electoral Count Act, so they could then put their sham plan into action. Yeah, now it's about integrity. And this is what I love about Republicans. They're smart. They're smart. The moneyed interests pay smart people to come up with Plan B always. You know, like last weekend we had the Insurrection 2.0 that didn't really happen. Immediately you had Plan B, 15,000 Haitians, that somehow just showed up in Texas in one place under a bridge. We now find out, there was a lot of planning that went into that, all on WhatsApp. Hey, you know, and who used WhatsApp a lot? Oh, yeah, the last guy's son-in-law. There's a lot of craziness and stuff going on. Just amazing and remarkable stuff, I'll be honest with you. So, here we are. You got this sham of an audit. And I love that the draft report says that the election results are inconclusive, because you have to keep the fraud alive. One way or another, the fraud has to stay alive. And this is where it's at. The frustrating part of this to me is there are going to be people who go, no, Rick, understand. You know, they were really caring about, you know, the other stuff, you know, the stuff that they were making up. They're really caring about integrity. You know, they're really caring about, you know, the process. They cared about people. That's what it was really about. It was about that, not anything else. No, no. So, you know, I'm looking at this just going, in some level, can we please stop with the insanity? Can we please stop with the craziness? And the answer is absolutely, positively, no. Because this was never about the election. It was about setting up the steal and setting up future steals. It's about conning the connable. It's about the dim. And sadly, there are a lot of dim on that side. Because here's the great part of this whole story. The cyber ninja people had absolutely no prior experience in doing what they did. But what they were eyeball deep in the whole stop the steal thing. So this, again, it was what it was. It was all about creating that narrative for the 2-page memo, 6-point plan to overturn our elections, but also, I believe, future theft, which is coming. It's coming. So my thought, fool, money, soon parted. We've seen this. And I'll tell you, nowhere is that phrase, and I've heard that a bunch of times, I've heard that a lot. Nowhere is that more apparent than in some of the garbage we're seeing on Facebook and other social media platforms. This whole idea that you can't trust the medical establishment, you can't trust your doctors, you can't trust that hospital. The people who are, you know, institutionally, you know, they spent decades, you know, honing their craft and caring for people, they can't be trusted. And this is really what 40 years of Reaganomics and Reagan-esque government bashing and conspiracy theories will get you. This is what all of the tinfoil hat crowd who have found themselves on Facebook and all the cuckookery of, you know, oh, there's a pizza place with a child porn ring in the basement that doesn't have a basement. That's what this stuff gets you. And there were a couple of stories that caught my attention today. One over at the Washington Post of this doctor, or I mean this pulmonologist who really just had enough. Went home, blasted out this long Facebook post about, you know, how, you know, he's lost over 100 patients. And, you know, even on their deathbed, some people are denying that they got COVID or it exists. Or, you know, give me ivermectin or I'm going to sue. Or, you know, the Lynn Wood thing from a couple of weeks ago. This is one of those moments where their just pure stupidity. And it's in this mindset that this guy goes, look, I've lost over 100 people. And you've got these people, who don't believe because they've been on Facebook or in these Facebook groups are telling them, no, it's all a scam and it's horrible. And, you know, had family members tell him, well, no, we don't believe you. Get me another doctor. You know, just all kinds of stupidity that has come from us. And there was a quote in an I think it was an NBC article, if I'm not mistaken. A quote by this doctor, this Harvard medical school physician, who quoted this term vigilante medicine, which I thought was the perfect frame. She says it's vigilante medicine, medicine being practiced by lay people who are reading groups created by other lay people in echo chambers and silos that likely someone in the anti-vax movement is profiting from. And I've been saying this from the beginning. Whenever one of these new, hey, I've got this. Remember it was silver, something silver at the beginning? Just take this silver stuff and you'll be immune. You'll be fine. It won't get you. Just send us $29.95 and say three Hail Marys and voila, you're now doused in the blood of Jesus. And, you know, I go, no. But people were buying it because they believed. And then it was, what was it? It was the hydroxychloroquine that Trump was pitching. It was somebody actually did drink the bleach. And I'm sure a lot of people shoved the light up the backside. And then it was these other things that keep popping up. You know, I'm waiting for somebody to, you know, like mix lima beans and something with gasoline and kerosene or who knows what. This kind of snake oil salesmanship, it's the American way. It really is. Everybody comes up with their latest elixir or, you know, their tonic. And usually it's just alcohol to make you forget that you feel anything. But in this case, this stuff can really do harm. You know, when I was reading about ivermectin, and especially the stuff you buy at like Walmart or Tractor Supply, not the stuff you get from a doctor, I'm going, this is bad. Especially when you're talking about in doses that are made for like 2,000 pound animals, and you're like a, you know, 200 pound guy going, yeah, give me a double dose, because if one's good, two's better. Somebody is making a profit off this. Now, you know, they pointed out in this article that there are some, you know, these Facebook pages like Ivermectin MD team, where they, I guess you can go into and they have all these miracle cures. And of course, they're for sale. And let's not forget the prayer warriors who, if you send them a donation, they'll pray for your good health. They'll pray nobody breathes on you and you get infected. But it's always been about the grift. It's all been about, you know, the angle that you see these people play. Understand, the right-wing loonies of this media environment, they're all selling you beet juice or some kind of supplement or concoction or some kind of, you know, wish, hope, and pray thing that is, in my view, nothing but a fraudulent scam. But you got believers. I believe. And they suck it up. And look, there are industries into this. So am I surprised that you've got stupid people who are listening to these folks going, no, that healthcare establishment, they just want to kill you. They want to get you into the hospital because hospitals where people go to die. And it is. It's the place where you go when you're really freaking sick. They're saying, no, get out of the hospitals. Go home and take all of these concoctions or elixirs or go home and become a chemist in your own basement. And, you know, you got some lacquer here, little liquor over here. Mix it all together. See what you get. What do you got to lose? You're dying anyway. So if you got COVID and you're about ready to go on the ventilator, just go home. I guess that's the view, because they believe the healthcare establishment is hell-bent on getting them vaccinated so that they can protect themselves, but they don't want to be. And I say, you know what? I don't want you to be either. Because I sat and I thought about this. I go, this is really the stupidest thing that I've heard. It really is. This is one of those moments where you go, is this the future of the country? Because these people aren't doing this out of need. They're doing it out of pure idiocy, out of pure stupidity. And I've come to this conclusion. I've come to this position, and I know it's bad for my soul. It's bad karma. It's bad juju. However you wanna frame that. Go. Leave the resources to people who want them. Everyone needs help when they're ill, when they're hurting. Everyone needs medical attention when things are bad. I think we should start with the people who want it. This idea that, you know, they're going to force anything on you is ridiculous. I don't think anything should be forced on you. You have choices. But this is the weird part. The weird part is what my choice friends never think about is with every decision that they make, there are consequences. And it's those consequences that they don't want to absorb. The consequence that if you get sick, right now what we're seeing, the numbers are bearing it out in this story of this doctor in Michigan who said, look, I've lost more people than I want to remember. Is it you're going to die? That's the consequence. And, you know, he said that there are people who deny the virus from their deathbed. And I got to tell you, there's part of me that goes, you know, I respect you for that. I respect you taking that to your grave. You know, having that epiphany on your deathbed going, oh, gee, I was wrong. Give me the vaccine now. I think that's on the halfway kind of copping out. If you're going to believe something, go all the way with it. Or maybe just wake them up. I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm reading through these stories and I'm going, explain to me how it is that you're going to believe something that you read on a social media platform by JoJo the idiot boy in his basement who's just trying to get an extra click or a like or a share or maybe get you to send him a buck, and you're not going to believe your doctor. Now, fortunately, we're seeing doctors across the country going, look, if you're not vaccinated, I'm not treating you. I'm not going to waste my time. I'm not going to bother. Don't come. And maybe that's where it has to go. Maybe that is part of the consequence. I've heard people say we should be denying people. I've heard people say we should be raising their rates. I've heard all kinds of ideas on what needs to happen as a consequence. And that stuff is coming. But this idea that you're going to trust someone that you, an ad that you saw on Facebook over your local doctor is just mind-numbingly insane. But then again, these are the same people who believe that, you know, Donald Trump won Arizona. When the reality is he's, what, lost like 65 times now? Fun, fun times. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Nothing more American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1875. That was the day anti-black violence erupted into a two-day massacre in Clinton, Mississippi. As many as 2,500 black Republicans and their families met at Moss Hill, a former plantation destroyed during the Civil War. The day was one of festivities and political speeches ahead of the fall elections. The county Republican Party invited local Democrats to debate. The Democratic state senatorial candidate did address the crowd. The editor of a local Republican newspaper and union officer, Captain H.T. Fisher, followed him. Soon, a group of white Democrats began to heckle Fisher as he spoke. Republican politicians attempted to quell the growing tensions. Almost immediately, however, the heckling whites opened fire on the crowd. Women and children fled in all directions as black Republican forces rushed to defend themselves and their families. By the end of the day, three whites and five blacks were killed. Clinton's mayor fed off rumors of black retaliation. He called upon white paramilitary forces, the White Liners, from surrounding areas for assistance. Several hundred answered the call and filled the town's streets. Historian Melissa Janczewski-Jones notes that though heavily armed, the White Liners accompanied white locals as they rampaged door to door looking for black Republicans to murder. After 2 days, as many as 50 black Clintonians were killed by white Democrats looking to end Reconstruction and regain political control of Mississippi. A Senate committee would later conclude, quote, the riots at Clinton were part of a special purpose on the part of the Democrats to break up the meetings of Republicans and inaugurate an era of terror
not only in those communities, but throughout the state.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So again, Donald Trump lost Arizona by more votes. Let me highlight the fact that he lost by more votes this time than all of the other previous times that we've recounted these votes. But again, it's not about, remember, they've already moved the goalposts again. It's not about the vote count. It's not about who won or lost. It's about how we played the game. It's about the process and integrity. The weird thing is now Trump's officially lost Arizona more than any president in the history of the country, which I gotta tell you, I love. For me, the question now becomes, what does this mean for the attacks that we're seeing in places like Texas and Wisconsin, in my state of Pennsylvania, as the Republicans have really bought in, drank the whole pitcher of Kool-Aid of stopping the steal? And here to share some thoughts on how do we protect, here in my state, our personal information from an overreaching Republican Party who's hell-bent on not just gathering all of our personal data, but also some of the stuff about our machines. That's why I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes to come talk with us. Vince, appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me, partner.
So I'm looking at this, and again, I go back to this question. You know, what does this mean? I mean, Arizona went the way I think we all knew it was going to go. Trump lost. Yeah, that's been every time. What's this now mean for the crazy here in our state?
Well, it just shows this track record that every time they go down this process, that they lose, and that it's really no, there's no credibility. There's no there. There is clearly no integrity with what it is that they're trying to get done. It just really should embolden all of us to really call this out for what it is. If you review all of these cases, you review all of these situations, even in the Michigan decision, which if you go back just a couple months and read the decision in Michigan, where the Republican leadership who led the recount process in Michigan blasted the Trump forces. The lawyers are being currently, as we speak, are being sanctioned, Rick. All right. So this is just absurd. Now, what does it mean for Pennsylvania? All of us don't need, you know, we need to take a minute, enjoy the Arizona victory, but we need to stay on point here in Pennsylvania, because the information that they're seeking is so intrusive to our own personal realities.
Right.
Every registered voter, and I think we have to repeat it, Rick, it's important that we repeat it. For every registered voter, not only your name, not only your address, your social security number, your driver's license, your voting history, the actual ballots that were cast, and your email address. And then as tied into that, as you know, Rick, when you do a vote by mail ballot, you provide that email address and you provide that number for folks to call.
Correct.
You know, to notify you the status of your vote by mail ballot. So this level of intrusion into our process, not telling us where that information is going to be stored, who's going to have access to it. You know, this, we really need to stay on point on this. And you tie that to the pursuit in Texas. Now, why they're pursuing Texas, I don't know, because they won Texas handily. All right. But they're even going for the same kind of deal in Texas. And you tie that this is not about winning the election. This is really about causing disdain for the process, the disdain for democracy, and really creating something otherworldly here with respect to who wins and loses.
Right. And I would argue, you know, I agree with you. This wasn't about overturning the election. This wasn't about winning. This, in my view, and you can disagree, this is about data mining. This is about getting all of our information and having everything at their disposal. And not just that, and what we saw in Arizona, it wasn't just about that information. It was about the machines and the software and all of the components. So for me, this wasn't about uncovering some past steal. For me, it's about the future steal and them having the information to be able to do that and us providing it to them.
Absolutely. I think I think you're on point. You know, remember, and I think you and I have said this before, with Trump, it's always follow the money. It's always follow the money. When you have that kind of data about so millions of American people, you can make, you can monetize that, which is what he does, okay, or he tries to figure out. And it's always the search for the cash to cover whatever expenses that he's had or whatever expenses that he anticipates on having. Because if I remember correctly, he's got an $800 million debt due in the next year or two. And I'm not sure quite yet how he's going to pay that off.
Yeah, and he's not going to be able to go to the MyPillow guy because he's going to be broke after these Dominion voter, these cases that are going on right now. And I look at these guys, and look, the big news this week, Vince, as you know, was the two-page memo, the six-point plan on how really they were going to steal the election. And you now look at all of this stuff in the rearview mirror, all the stuff in Georgia, this debacle in Arizona, and here in Pennsylvania with Mastriano and his crowd. It isn't about, you know, stopping a steal that didn't happen. It's really about the future steals and what they could have gotten away with had they been able to get that guy in Georgia to go, oh, okay, we're not going to certify.
Yeah, again, you're on point. It is about the future. And creating this sense of instability or perceived instability in our electoral system, when the truth of the matter is, in Pennsylvania, it worked extremely well. In Arizona, it worked extremely well. In Michigan, it worked extremely well. In Wisconsin, it worked extremely well. All of these cases, everything has worked well, but they want to cause instability within our own minds, so that we do not trust the system in any way, shape, or form. And the only folks who win out in that situation are those who already are financially well suited.
Yeah, you know what's interesting? What's interesting to me, Vince, is I look at people like the MyPillow guy. I look at Rudy Giuliani. I look at Sidney Powell, Lynn Wood. At one point, these were respected people, mostly in their communities. They are now kind of, you know, they're kind of clowns. They're viewed kind of as clowns. And I argue they weren't read in on what was really going on because they were running around the country spewing these, now we know, fraudulent conspiracy theories, and they're true believers. Now, granted, they never took one of those conspiracy theories into a court of law, which tells me at least they understood that. But they've been true believers all along. When do we finally get to go, they're all liars, they're all fraudulent thieves? When do we put them aside and go, now we got to move forward?
I think, Rick, for the salvation of this country, the salvation of this democracy, I don't think we need to let up on pursuing justice and pursuing the truth. I don't think we can just say, Rick, that, all right, gotcha, Arizona didn't happen, you know, Michigan didn't happen, Wisconsin didn't happen, we gotcha, we see the memo, we see what you guys are really about. When, you know, I'm a believer that when you got somebody, you gotta expose them all the way.
Right.
You can't just let a little bit get shown and then walk away and let them off the hook. I think you have to go to the depths of where this conspiracy started, how widespread it was, how deep it was in every level of our nation, and expose each one, and all of them need to be rooted out and adjudicated in a court of law.
And for me, starting with Doug Mastriano, and I know he's one of your colleagues, but you know, for me, that's one of the people that have to go. And all these people who are in your chamber, especially your chamber, who are pushing this gathering of all of our information. I mean, these are supposed to be the people who believe in small, less intrusive government. That's what Republicans used to believe. They didn't want big, overarching government. In fact, I've had Republicans tell me the reason we're so afraid of the state is we have trust in the local governments, and every one of the 67 counties control their own data. This is not only breaking the soul of their ideology, but this is a massive power grab for one reason. In my view, it's about stealing future elections.
It is. You're on case. You said it right on point. they have historically said, and I've been around the legislature for a long time, they have historically said, return it to the locals, let them handle it at the local level. Now, 63 of the 67 counties, you know, did a recount, Rick, and they found that the elections were there were no problems. There was no fraud. They certified each one of those elections. Now they want to throw out that entire process. These are folks who have some very, very desperate attitudes about themselves and where they're going with this. We need to be all very concerned, and pursue them and pursue justice. And they all need to be doing some serious court time as far as I'm concerned.
I'm right there with you. You know, listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes. Vince, you know, before we get into, you know, some of the other things I want to go down, I wanted to get your thoughts of the two-page memo that came out, that six-point plan to basically steal the presidential election. Now, I said from the beginning, none of it's new. It's all stuff they trial ballooned in November, all things we had talked about on this program, you know, leading up. But the fact that it was so well written, concise, in such a two-page format for Donald Trump to read, really sent chills down my spine. Look, I'm fully cognizant of the fact that they would do that without blinking an eye. But the fact that someone methodically laid that out with such clarity kind of scared me, kind of sends chills down my spine.
Rick, there's an old movie, an old is relative, you know, in some spaces, called 7 Days in May. And I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster and, yep. And a few other, Ava Gardner, a few other, you know, some of the great actors of our time. And it talks about this conspiracy that was set up by a general who wanted to overthrow a sitting president. And it was very well put together, very well crafted, great levels of detail in the scheme, but in the end, democracy won out. A lot of this continues to remind me of that movie. It continues to remind me the scheming, the plotting, you remember in that last 60-day period or last 30-day period, Trump was firing folks in different departments and different agencies and replacing them with flunkies who did not know anything about the particular mission that they had. It reminds me of this whole effort to try to put people in position so that when he called it, action would take over.
They would say yes. You know, the thing that gets me is, you know, Dan Quayle. I'm like, you know, I didn't even know. I'm glad he's okay. Didn't know Dan Quayle was alive. History will now not remember him for misspelling potato.
No. Who would have thunk you? Dan Quayle.
Dan Quayle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Vice President. We appreciate you being blunt, as is said. I guess that's in peril, right? You know, in the book Peril. Thank you for being blunt to Pence, to Mike Pence, and telling him what his responsibility really is.
The frightening thing to me, though, Vince, is that Mike Pence had to ask someone. That, to me, that's the frightening part. That it wasn't visceral. Hell no, we're not doing this. This is
he was searching for a way to do what Trump wanted him to do. Okay.
Yep. He was searching for a way to say yes.
Help me figure this out. Help me find a way. And everywhere he went, it sounds like everywhere he went, he got shut down. And finally, in the end, by Vice President.
And we need this. Now, I understand on Monday there's an event. Our good friend, Senator Art Haywood, and his wife are holding an event. They're going to sue the Department of State here in Pennsylvania to protect their voter information. I think you guys have done the same thing in the Senate. I want to be able to sign on this. I have listeners who say they want to sign on. What do we do to protect our information from this power grab by the GOP and the Senate?
I think, look, Art Haywood is a good friend of mine, as he is of yours. And I think we just need to reach out to him, sign on to, he's looking for folks to sign on. He's looking for folks to join in. You know, we've set up the Senate Democratic Caucus has set up a website protectpavoters.com that folks can go to and register their concern. And we need to, again, Rick, and I'm going to say this over and over again. It's one of the reasons why I said, let me join my friend Rick tonight, is we need to not let up. In spite of everywhere we're going, we're seeing some victories. We need to not let up. It is the same attitude that is blocking president, that is going down this path and trying to upend our democracy, that is blocking progress in Washington, D.C. with respect to President Biden's economic agenda and the infrastructure program and the human infrastructure program and the new voting rights bills we need to see passed. It is that same philosophy. We've got to shut this down here, because if we shut it down here, we can also shut the opposition down to the other things that we know are important to Pennsylvania's people.
Yeah, and because I'm looking at this, Vincent, and the thing that gets me is all of this memo to me this week was kind of the smoking gun. And now we see this report coming out of Arizona. You put all this stuff together, and I don't know how, if I'm a supporter of Donald Trump, I can now wake up and go, yeah, I'm still a believer. I don't know how this doesn't make you just turn away and say, this isn't right. I have an epiphany that maybe I've been duped. I'm not sure, but all of this stuff piling on one after another, at some point, does this not have to wake people up?
I would hope it wakes people up, but you know what? I think what it may take, Rick, some significant individual doing some hard time.
Yeah, no, okay? I want that.
All right, I think because there's been so much leading up to this moment that should have been enough proof. So much.
I agree. No, okay? I'm hoping that President Biden does release the information from January 6th. I know it's unprecedented. I know Trump is going to try to use the Executive Privilege Act, but what they did on that day is disgraceful. The Confederate flag in our Capitol, disgraceful, and somebody needs to be held accountable. Granted, we didn't hold Reagan accountable back in the 80s. We didn't hold W. Bush accountable for Iraq. We didn't hold the banksters accountable for crashing our economy. We got to hold these people accountable.
It was an insurrection. And you can't punish an insurrection by 30 days time served.
That's it. No slap on the wrist. I'm with you.
But I think someone very significant is going to have to serve some serious time to get folks to come to some reality that this is what this thing has been all about.
It's got to be big. Got to be big. Senator Hughes, I appreciate you taking time for us. Great stuff as always.
My man, Rick. Take care, buddy.
Appreciate it. Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1918. That was the day that the Industrial Workers of the World Union was banned in Canada. The Industrial Workers of the World Union had grown steadily in Canada, reaching as many as 10,000 members by 1911. The union was especially strong in mining, logging, and the textile industry. But backlash against the radical union was mounting in the United States and in Canada. Swept up in Red Scare hysteria, the governments of both nations targeted the IWW. With the beginning of World War I, labor unions that dared to threaten strikes or to speak out against militarization were met with harsh reprisals. By 1914, the Canadian IWW had less than 1,000 members. In May of 1918, 18 Canadian IWW leaders were arrested while they attended a meeting in Ottawa. Those arrested were immigrants and were sent to a labor internment camp. Then the Canadian government moved to ban the organization altogether. The ban against the IWW would last until the end of World War I. Those found to be affiliated with the union faced up to 5 years in prison. 13 other organizations were also banned in Canada, including the Chinese Labor Association and the Social Labor Party. The act further read that it was illegal to attend meetings, except religious services, during the present war at which the proceedings are conducted in the language of any country with which Canada is at war, or in the languages of Russia, Ukraine, or Finland. After the war, the IWW was once again allowed in Canada and slowly began to rebuild. But the scars inflicted during the war years took a lasting toll on the union's membership. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some great news today. Great news. Captain Kirk is going to space. That's right. William Shatner is going to space on the next Bezos penis rocket to wherever. It is going the Blue Origin New Shepard rocket next month. Captain Kirk going to space. Oh boy. National pride. Yes. Meanwhile, over at Costco, their CEO, Richard Galanti, said yesterday that Costco is going to be putting, quote, some purchase limitations on key items. Yes, here we go with the rationing of toilet paper, bottled water, paper towels, cleaning products. I got to tell you, I never knew people wiped and washed so much or were so paranoid about wiping and washing. But here we go again. And here to share some thoughts on our broken supply chain and maybe how bad it's going to be for the big Christmas buying season, I've asked David Dayen to come talk with us. David is the executive editor over at the American Prospect. David, thanks for taking some time for us.
You got it. How you doing, Rick?
So we're all going to be rationed again. No more toilet paper for you. I hope you're stocked.
I'm good. But yeah, I mean, a lot of this is really a continuation of the problems that started at in March of 2020. I mean, the way that the global supply chain works, it takes a long time to get things through the system. And tangles that might have started a year ago are showing up on our shores today. And so the fact that we're still seeing dangerous workplaces because of the Delta variant, the fact that the ultimate fact that we have a lot of production centralized in one part of the world in China, and they have a zero COVID policy, so they're shutting down factories a lot. They've had a tremendously bad weather season. They shut down the Yangtze River at one point because of flooding. And that's going to show up where we are. And it exacerbates the problems we've already been seeing over the last year because of this mismatch between the supply coming in from China and the supply going out.
Yeah. Now, this is something, you know, obviously, while we were in lockdown and while the pandemic was at its height, you know, we understood that there are going to be some things that are going to be kind of hard to get back online. You just don't flip the switch and the economy fire right back up. But for me, this pandemic has highlighted what I've been talking about for years. And that is, as you pointed out, globalization has made us dependent on somewhere else and somewhere else that's kind of hard to get to instead of just around the corner products made by Joe, your neighbor. For me, the lesson out of this is maybe we need to be pulling back from so much globalization and reshore what we do.
Yeah, and it's more than that too, right? Because it's not just the fact that everything's centralized and that we have one region of the world that's sort of the world's manufacturer. It's also centralized within the particular products. We have one company that makes this, you know, you have Foxconn making a great deal of the world's electronics. You know, I wrote a book about one of the chapters was about how IV bags, salt and water in a bag, is primarily made by one company, primarily in Puerto Rico. So when the Hurricane Maria came through, all of a sudden there was this shortage. There's also another dimension to it, which is when you have these supply shocks, companies like Walmart, companies like Costco that are big enough can dictate to their suppliers, get us the goods first.
Prioritize,
right?
Yeah.
And so it spins down to the independents who don't have that buying power that's the same as the Walmarts and the Costcos of the world. And all of a sudden, if you're in a rural community and that's the corner store with, that you rely on, they can't get goods anymore. And so this is about centralization in a variety of different ways.
No, and you're right. I mean, not just globalization, but monopolies as well. And we've been told my whole life that, you know, capitalism, you know, is the way to go because you have multiple firms and all kinds of competition and all this stuff. So we don't have this centralized model. And look, I'm not an economist, but I always argued that isn't the end result of capitalism monopolies? I mean, doesn't the big fish always eat the little fish? And we end up in this kind of world that we're in now.
I mean, that's certainly what it's been for the last 40 years, because we've abandoned the very strong enforcement that we could have through the antitrust division of the Justice Department, through the Federal Trade Commission, to promote competition. And because they've been sort of taken off the beat, we're in the place that we are now. And a lot of this is just sort of weirdness, I believe this week we set a record in the ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles, where I am. There are over 60 container ships just sitting in the water. And part of this is the consolidation of global shipping. And these ships are bigger and bigger and bigger, and it just takes a longer time to actually unload them. And when you have supply snarls, like the third busiest port in the world in China shutting down for 2 weeks because of one COVID case, then you create this weird backlog, and it's just hard to work your way through it. It could take days to unload one container ship now. So this should give us a rethink about globalization, about centralization, and also about just-in-time production, about the concept of we don't have inventories anymore. We don't have redundancy in the supply chain anymore. All we do is we know that we need 10 widgets by Thursday, and through the global system, we'll get the 10 widgets by Thursday. Well, what happens when you don't get the 10 widgets?
Yep.
And that's what we're seeing right now.
No, and a perfect example is the PPE. You know, when people were trying to find N95 masks, and I have a lot of conservative friends who were yelling at the CDC from the beginning, not, you know, scaring people to death and go get masks quick, because they were afraid they were, and this is my view, you can disagree, but it's my view, they didn't put people into a panic because we needed those masks for hospitals, for our healthcare workers to stay safe, because they knew we didn't have the stockpiles that all of us thought we had. Just like you're saying, we should have had reserves. There should be inventories, but they're not.
And so what you end up with is gouging. And what you end up is the biggest fish are able to get the goods and the smaller guys lose out. A new kind of phenomenon that we're seeing here is Walmart, Amazon, the big guys chartering their own ships to go get goods and delivering them directly to themselves. We're seeing them create national logistics networks that other people can piggyback on. They call it supply chain as a service. So they're farming out the supply chain. So now not only are Walmart, companies like Walmart, edging out their competition, they're now directing the logistics for their competition. And think about the danger of that when you now are the reliant factor in whether your competitor gets their goods.
Wow.
It's a really dangerous system. And this whole thing, from PPE to semiconductors to toilet paper to everything, should really cause a rethink in our corridors of power. And I know that the Biden administration has done a couple of very good reports about reshoring. They've had discussions internally, but the clock is ticking, and we still have this problem. And the fact that it's gone on for so long shows how dangerous it is and shows how we got need to get started right away on the reshoring issue.
No, I'm right there with you. But how do you, in this environment, we can't agree to get an infrastructure package passed through that we've needed for decades, that everyone agrees we've needed for decades. We can't figure out how to get, you know, Granny a new set of glasses. How are we going to completely undo the tangled monster of globalization that decades of billionaires have profit off of? You know, how are we going to untangle this monster?
No, you're right. I mean, it's certainly going to be a game of inches. We had a very good bill that included a lot of money for domestic manufacturing. That was that China bill in the Senate, passed with 68 votes. The House has not taken it up. There are things in the infrastructure package to spur domestic manufacturing, particularly advanced manufacturing, green manufacturing, things like that, hasn't gotten through. So legislatively, we're a little bit stuck. There are incentives that you can do at the executive level to bring and encourage more manufacturing. You could crack down on corporate inversions. You could crack down on the outsourcing and leaking out of these various industries. You could create the conditions for American manufacturing to rebound. Another way that is actually in could be into the reconciliation bill is a federal financing authority for these companies that innovate and create these great designs, but then have to go to China to get them manufactured. So we don't have, sometimes it's called the valley of death. Like, you create this great innovative product, but you can't get it made here, and you can't get financing for it. So if we get the financing, then maybe you're able to continue here in the United States. So this is going to be a long effort, but you can't look at the last 18 months and think that it has to be abandoned, right? This is absolutely critical to our national security, to our prosperity, and frankly, to our survival.
No, it's stuff that I've been screaming about for the 16 years I've been doing this show. You cannot be a first world country without a manufacturing base. Sorry, if you don't make something, you can't really exist. And I think our inability to manufacture has come full circle. Now, here's what my fear is. You had all these companies who abandoned this country for cheap labor and exploitable environmental regulations, which, you know, to a CEO is like heroin. They need their fix of cheap labor, which is the reason they went to China and elsewhere. Are you saying to me now, they got their heroin fix, they got hugely profitable, they made tons of money, lined their pockets for themselves and their shareholder. Now we've got to pay them to come back so that they get even more wealthy and more powerful, and we now got to pick it up as working people so that we've got to pay to get our jobs back? Is that what I'm hearing here?
Well, I was talking about startups more than the established giants, which I think we should punish for shipping jobs overseas. Right now, they're subsidized, as you know, in the tax code.
Right.
I think that there are going to be a lot of ways to get this done and to work on this problem. But the first is admitting that there is a problem, right? And, you know, a lot of times the rhetoric from Congress, from policymakers is, this is the most powerful and richest country in the world. Why can't we do X, Y, and Z? If you can't go to the corner store and find toilet paper on the shelf, you are not the richest country in the world. I mean, bottom line.
That is absolutely the truth. That is simple. If we're worse off than the Soviets were back in the 80s, then maybe there's a problem. I listen to the Rick Smith Show here with David Day, and David's the executive editor of the American Prospect. He's got a new piece out, The Great Supply Shock We Brought Upon Ourselves. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Now, you in your article, you point out that this Evergrande company in China is about to collapse. And I don't think the Chinese government's going to bail them out. And as you point out, you know, real estate's about 30% of the national GDP. It seems like while we're dependent on them, it seems like that could be a house of cards that if they fall, we go with them. So from the national security point, isn't reclaiming some ability to make some stuff probably a good idea long term on that front as well?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the thing about consolidation and centralization like this is it magnifies disruptions. In a normal circumstance, if the second largest property owner in China happens to fall into a debt collapse, that's not going to be a major factor for us here in the United States. But if it's such a big part of their GDP that it affects their growth rate, and then factories have to close down, and those factories are supplying goods that we depend on, then yes, suddenly that becomes a problem. It's the same thing with, you know, a bad storm season. A bad storm season halfway around the world should not necessarily affect whether or not you can get cranberry sauce, or whether you can get a plastic toy for your kid for Christmas. But it is. And that's the larger problem. It magnifies disruptions. And we forgot somewhere along the line in our brilliant business schools, we forgot that redundancy is important. That is important for sustaining a workable capitalist economy, frankly. And so that I think we have to get back to that.
Yeah, I'm not going to give a pass on forgot. I think the system is working exactly the way it's supposed to. A handful of people getting wildly rich, richer than they could ever be, so that a guy like Jeff Bezos can take his phallic rocket up to space with Captain Kirk. That's what I think. And then the rest of us end up getting screwed, like these workers in China, by the way, who were basically forced into subsidizing this Evergrande, and now they're stiffed out of getting their money back as well.
Absolutely. I mean, labor injustice anywhere is a threat. And you know, the larger issue here is, who was it initially that created this outsourcing revolution, created this belief in globalization as a way to minimize your outlays and maximize your profits? And it was Wall Street. I mean, this was seen as the prime directive from Wall Street to raise your stock price, to make yourself attractive to investors. Yep. Is to become these multinationals that have no kind of loyalty to any kind of home country. You know, the Jack Welch idea that the country I should be part of is on a barge that goes around the world. That's where I should site my factory. That was the original sin, and that's, I think, what we have to attack when you think about how to restore this is end this short-term thinking. And end this primacy of Wall Street and financialization.
I'm right there with you. David, I appreciate the time. As always, great talk with you. Excellent work you do. Hope folks will take a look at the piece, The Great Supply Shock We Brought Upon Ourselves, written by David Dayan over at The American Prospect. David, thanks so much, man.
All right, Rick. Thanks.
Good stuff. Love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Do we need to be resourcing things quickly? I say yes. You can email me what you think, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1789. Congress passed the Judiciary Act of 1789. This act established the plan for the U.S. Supreme Court. At first, the court was comprised of just six justices, appointed by the president with Senate confirmation. The number of justices varied until 1869, when it became set at nine. The Constitution granted the Supreme Court jurisdiction over all laws, but especially those where constitutionality was an issue. The highest court has played a key role in deciding some of the most challenging issues facing the United States. Up until the 1800s, rulings related to labor law were decided by state courts, but the Supreme Court became the deciding body for many labor questions. It was the Supreme Court that upheld the jailing of Eugene V. Debs for violating an injunction against organizing a boycott of the Pullman Palace Car Company in 1894. Injunctions continued to be a tool against labor stoppages. In another famous case, the Lowell v. Leller case, often referred as the Danbury Hatters case, Dietrich Lowe refused to recognize the Hatters Union. He replaced striking workers with scabs. The strikers organized a nationwide boycott of Lowe's hats. Lowe sued, and the case made it all the way to the United States Supreme Court. In 1809, the Supreme Court ruled against the strikers. The Supreme Court often showed an anti-worker bias. In the 1918 case, Hammer versus Dagenhart, the court ruled Congress could not enact laws regulating child labor. In another early 1900s case, Lochner v. New York, the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional a New York law that mandated a limit of 10-hour workdays for bakers. Today, many important labor cases come before the Supreme Court. Do you think it's possible to return to the days of no minimum wage and child labor?